crush it within our carnal soul. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So all I need. So all I need. All I need. All I need. Oh, 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 oh.
Your love is all I need to be all so I can be. And I know that you see how much you need to me.
Love is all I need.
Aperture.
Welcome back. We met Javed Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javed as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled. It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten. But the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Sheer Muhammad Rahul. To get to Shame Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Sheer Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Sheer Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. but that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Gwadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Hore Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a hur or firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Hore Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Guadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Sheer Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilak. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hotags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheikh Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bash is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bash. When I ask him if he's ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment, a place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I too am proud of these honest, kind people, proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
got debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Relations between China and the United States continue to deteriorate from a trade war with Washington taxing and even sanctioning some Chinese entities to the U.S.'s promoting Taiwan as a separate nation to Washington's Navy presence in the Taiwan Strait have all been techniques used to pressure Beijing. Now, the waters are very murky between the two right now. And we will take a look at what the future may hold for China-U.S. ties in this debate.
The Chinese military on Saturday said it had tailed and monitored a U.S. warship as it passed through the Taiwan Strait. The military said the move deliberately raises the temperature of the Taiwan issue. It said the move jeopardizes peace and stability in the Strait. The Chinese military also accused the U.S. of using the Taiwan issue as a pawn for what it called selfish strategic purposes. The U.S. Navy, however, said its guided missile destroyer wasn't a routine mission in accordance with international law. China considers Taiwan as part of its own territory and is opposed to the increasing U.S. support for the island. Last week, the U.S. approved a new major arms sales to Taiwan in a deal worth $280 million. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. Washington says the sale aims to improve the security of Taiwan. But some analysts believe the U.S. seeks to push back against China.
The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope. It's trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, it's selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and China over other issues as well, from trade to the coronavirus pandemic and political developments in Hong Kong. The U.S. has also prepared a so-called entity list that mainly hits key Chinese industries over what Washington calls ties to China's military. On Thursday, the Pentagon said U.S. warships would be more assertive in responding to what it described as violations of international law. It accused China of being the most pressing long-term strategic threat. In response, China said it seeks no conflict with the U.S. and wants mutual respect and cooperation leading to a win-win outcome.
We hope that the U.S. side will take a rational and objective view of China's development of its national defense and armed forces, work with China to focus on cooperation, manage differences, and bring the China-U.S. relationship back to the right track.
The souring ties between China and the U.S. come in the wake of President Donald Trump's America First policy. With the incoming U.S. President Joe Biden set to take office on January 20th, it remains to be seen how the currently toxic relationship between the world's two biggest economies will look like. Will the new U.S. president stick to Trump's policy tools and continue the frictions? Will he try to de-escalate the tensions, or will he take a more aggressive anti-China approach?
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, journalist and political commentator Lawrence Freeman, out of Baltimore, and political analyst Angelo Giuliano out of Montreux, Switzerland. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start this off with Lawrence. Now, Washington says Taiwan is a separate nation. China says it is part of the People's Republic of China. According to international law, it is one country with two governments. What does it all mean in your perspective?
This idea of China being one country with two governments has been accepted for many, many years. And to disrupt this political understanding is quite dangerous. The problem is that President Trump, even though he started out trying to establish friendly, cordial, amiable relations with President Xi Jinping, has deteriorated and now has adopted the geopolitical doctrine, which says that there's a zero-sum game in the world as a chessboard, and there are either winners or losers. And the United States has now determined under President Trump that it has to have hegemony and has to put down and keep under China, which is emerging as a great superpower and a very powerful economy. this doctrine is unfortunate, and it's a problem for both the United States and China and for the world, because it can get quite dangerous, as we're seeing in your description earlier.
Well, Angelo, why does the United States want to stir up this hornet nest with China, when both, as our previous guests said, I mean, as a matter of fact, with souring relations, it would appear that both actually would suffer. So why stir up this hornet nest?
I think the USA, they know too well that Taiwan, pushing for Taiwan independence is the line not to cross. And this could be a case for war. So basically, they're using Taiwan as a pawn against China. So lately, the US has invested deeply a lot into the DPP, which is the ruling party in Taiwan. And this party is advocating for independence. So China's sovereignty over Taiwan is the line not to cross, and the U.S. is trying to use this as a pawn in either to probably to go into a negotiation of the coming new reset of the new world order, which would be which a lot of things would be renegotiated, including trading and currency and debt. So I think in the best case it's a pawn for the decision. In the worst case, it's using Taiwan for putting war in the region.
Okay, well, Lawrence, what do you think? Is the rift between the U.S. and China mostly because Washington cannot tolerate any other country except itself being on top, and China has already taken over the slot for having the largest economy, and it's threatening to surpass Washington in other fields?
Yes, well, this is a problem, because actually the U.S. interest, as an American, I know what the U.S. interests are, and the U.S. interests are not to be antagonistic to China. There are great things that the two superpowers and the two great economies, two largest economies, can accomplish in the future. So this is not in the American interest. What you have is you have an ideology best represented by people like Secretary of State Pompeo, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and many, many others. They believe that China is a threat. It's not a threat. It can be a collaborator. It can be an ally in development in many areas, which I could outline. So this is a doctrine alien to actually what the United States stands for. We could be working with China on space and technology. We could be working with China on developing the rest of the world, including Africa. There are many areas of common interest. There is no basis for this conflict and this tension, which President Trump did not espouse when he first came into office. But unfortunately, he's given into it, and it also fits in with the prejudices of his base of supporters who are anti-China. Anti-China, China, China is not in the American interest. It's a danger to the United States. And if there ever was even the idea of decoupling the United States from China, it would be a disaster. And as our friend has reported, it is a causability for war if the United States keeps supporting Taiwan.
What about that, Angela? Do you agree with our previous guests? And if so, if it's not in the interest of the United States, whose interest is it in? Why are we seeing then this policy being implemented?
I think it's important to see who's really ruling the U.S. We have Biden and Trump being the face, but behind, there are people who have the informal power, which are the military complex and the bankers. So I think it's very important to know that those are only puppets in the front, just, you know, and behind, they're putting pressure because a lot of money, a lot of people are benefiting from war and from tensions, especially the military complex. So, and then I think there's a cultural problem in the U.S. because there's this culture of exceptionalism to be the best and to want to export Western culture values. And there's a deep misunderstanding of China. I personally have lived 25 years in China, and I only now start to really understand what is behind the culture and what Chinese want. And while in the U.S. there's not this is not the slightest understanding of what China, the aspiration of China. China is not looking for hegemony, has a history of not interfering in other countries' affairs, and what it wants is prosperity for its people. That's all it wants. So there's a deep misunderstanding, and so the hawks are just using the misunderstanding and the media just to further demonize China.
Yeah, what about that, Lawrence? Angela said some interesting things there, trying to demonize China, and there's a misunderstanding culturally, and that the United States or Americans always feel that they should be number one. But on the other hand, if we look at the advances of China, especially if we look at technologically, the U.S. is actually behind China technologically, and yet there's always this image, Americans themselves, that they should be number one, they have to be the best, and it appears almost that Washington will do anything in its power to stop competition, unfortunately not in a fair way. Your take?
Unfortunately, over the last 50 years, I'm a senior citizen now, I've watched the whole process unfold. The United States culture has declined, has shrunk, and Americans don't think on the highest level these days. And Angela is correct. People don't know anything about China. If you look at Confucian philosophy, there is a coherence between Confucian philosophy and Judeo-Western culture in the idea of the common interest of mankind. China has performed a modern-day economic miracle in lifting 750 to 800 million people out of poverty. This could be a benefit to the world. China has just brought back Chang'e 5 with rocks from the moon, which we can now examine, which will benefit humanity. They also have put a rover on the far side of the moon. There's many things that China is doing in science and economics in terms of the Belt and Road and the infrastructure they're bringing to various nations of the world, including Africa. This is something that the United States has a shared interest in. It benefits all of mankind. And Angela is right. You have a military-industrial complex. You have a group of bankers, financial elite in Wall Street, in London, in Paris, who want to maintain their political power, its financial political power, and they see China and Russia to some extent attempting to usurp that power. That's geopolitics. There is no zero-sum game. Great nations can work together to accomplish great things for mankind. And as an American, I would plead with my fellow Americans to start thinking more strategically, more clearly, and don't buy into the propaganda that's coming out of Pompeo and the State Department.
Well, Angelo, do you see a different foreign policy approach with China under a Biden presidency as opposed to the current U.S. administration? Or do you think we're going to continually see this clash and perhaps even greater clashing? Your assessment?
I would say in the short term, it might get better. But in the long term, it might be more inclined to go to war. I think on the form, we saw Trump as being very arrogant, using not very appropriate words, but it's only the wording, it's only a facade. I don't think, I think we need to look at facts. No matter if we like or not Trump, in the last 4 years, he hasn't gone to war. While I would doubt that Biden wouldn't have his own war with China. So I think I'm very negative about Biden. Mm-hmm. I don't think he will get better.
You're saying that under a Biden administration, you feel that it's going to be more hawkish than the previous administration?
Absolutely. If you look at the cabinet and the people surrounding Biden, they come from the Obama era and also from the Bush era. And those ones, they were all criminals. All criminals. If you look at what they did in Libya, in Yemen, and around the world, they're just criminals. So basically, they need wars. Those Biden needs probably his war. Every president needs his war. And I think the possibilities of war are between, it could be Iran, it could be Venezuela, or it could be China. I think it's very hard to predict, but now we can see some advanced indicators that there's a continuation of a pivot to Asia, and this is not a coincidence that we see warships in the South China Sea.
Well, Lawrence, how likely then, you've just heard, and what our other guests have said, your perspective, how likely is it that these tensions could increase and actually lead to a military confrontation under a Biden term?
I would say there is increasing possibilities that that could occur. If you look at the people that President-elect Biden has picked for his cabinet, they do come from the Obama crowd, which launched the Asian pivot in early 2011 against China. They come from some of them come from the Clinton administration, and you have a loud, ignorant chorus of voices coming out of the Democratic Party leadership and the Republican Party, all in an anti-China propagandist mode. And if you look at the people that Biden has, these are people around him who have carried out regime change, who have carried out sanctions, who have carried out and escalated wars. And even though people don't like President Trump's style, and I don't like it, he has not escalated any war. And I think under the Biden administration, we should definitely be concerned that the group of people he's now putting in his government, and he himself and other leading Democrats, could well lead us into a war. It's a very dangerous situation. Unfortunately, Trump has fallen into very bad policy advisors listening to them on China. So he's leaving the administration on a very sour note with China. And I think Biden will come in and may well escalate the antagonism between the two nations. And all it takes is a small incident somewhere in the South China Sea, and you could see the beginning of a military conflict. I'm very concerned about the Biden administration and its hawkish attitudes toward China, which is already broadcast in various comments it's made. This is a serious, serious problem for us in the United States.
Angela, what about the use of sanctions? We've seen the U.S. now using sanctions to stop Chinese competition for American companies inside of the States, and they've even tried to put pressure on other countries to do the same. Do you see a continuation of this under a Biden administration, trying to block Chinese companies inside of the United States, and also making sure that Washington dictates to other countries to make sure that they also will sanction Chinese companies? How likely is that?
Absolutely. I think the direction the U.S. wants to take is towards decoupling. And I think we've seen Pompeo touring all around the world to pushing for countries to take sides. And this is a very big problem, especially in the Asian area. A lot of countries do not want to take sides. They want peace, but with the U.S., I think they will have a hard time just to have the countries to side with them. I think one of the very few countries in the region that is siding is Australia, but I don't see Japan and other countries siding for the U.S. So it's just a move to further isolate China, and I think this will not work.
And Lawrence, we're almost out of time, but your take, I mean, if you were given the opportunity to actually advise the new American administration that's going to take over in a couple of weeks, what would you say? What would be the way that the United States should be handling foreign relations with China?
I think the United States should recognize we have a common interest with China. As the two economic powerhouses in the world, there are many positive things we can do together. For example, space. Exploring space is one of the most important developments for mankind, to learn the laws of the universe, to discover them for all the benefit of mankind. We should also use China's Belt and Road in their elimination of poverty. I'm an African specialist, and we have 600 million people without electricity in Africa, 400 million people living in poverty. If the United States and China combine their forces and their outlook together and their powers, we could eliminate poverty in Africa and other parts of Southeast Asia. These are the kinds of wonderful things that could be done together. We could develop nuclear power, fusion energy, which we've been on the drawing board for a half a century. All these things are possible when powers like the United States and China would collaborate for the better, beneficial development of mankind.
Okay.
And this is what I represent, and this is what the United States should be.
Angela, your take. Do you think that China would actually be willing? You've just heard our other guests discuss the way forward. If he had an opportunity to tell the United States, do you think that China, Beijing, would be willing to cooperate and work with the Americans?
Absolutely. Beijing is looking every opportunity to reconcile with the U.S. He wants to share a future with the U.S. It's not either China or the U.S. They want to work for multiple worlds. And I think this is a China becoming the largest superpower or just getting to the level of the U.S., I think it's a huge opportunity for the world. It's an opportunity just to go from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. It's an opportunity to get out of the American hegemony and the neocolonialism, because we are still half of the world is colonized. If you look at the impact, the pressure the U.S. is putting in South America and in Africa, I think with China would be very different. China could give back dignity to the greater South and could help in decolonize the world, but this is obviously what the U.S. doesn't want.
Okay.
I am for peace. I like very much what our colleague just said before. I am for peace. I think we have huge opportunities, but there are some evil forces that do not think the same as we do. And those evil forces are people, the bankers, and whoever is ruling now the U.S. And it's
okay.
A sad reality.
Unfortunately, I am out of time, but I appreciate both of you being with us for this debate. Journalist and political commentator Lawrence Freeman out of Baltimore, and political analyst Angela Giuliano out of Montreux, Switzerland. Appreciate both of you being with us, and as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you next time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
Studying in military academies and in armed forces organizations is one of the loftiest and most valuable endeavors. Why? It is so because by studying these universities, our youth enter the armed forces with the purpose of ensuring the security of the country, and security is a noble and fundamental value for the country. It is a vital element because without it, all other important values of the country will be disrupted. Values including welfare, justice, pursuit of knowledge, and other such values. Therefore, presence in these universities is a very important opportunity and a very valuable task. Studying and graduating from these academies will prepare you for being engaged in one of the most valuable endeavors, that of ensuring the security of your country and your nation.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, apart from ensuring security, the armed forces have other important duties, one of the most important of which is rendering public services to the nation. The Army, the Guards Corps, the Police Force, and Basij have rendered all kinds of services to the Iranian nation in previous years, particularly in recent years, including infrastructural services and construction of dams, refineries, and the like. In the arena of health and treatment, the armed forces have accomplished a great feat by working in the area of polio vaccines. Today, too, when it comes to the issue of coronavirus, the armed forces are really in the middle of the arena, and they are presenting all necessary services. In the area of livelihood projects, many good tasks are being carried out by the armed forces. Of course, they do not announce and promote them in the media, but they are carrying out very satisfactory tasks, which we are aware of. We could equally refer to their participation in the Pious Assistance and Charity Movement.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah, Alhamdulillah.